Good afternoon. This is Tanya Schultz with Social Chats No Aging. I am live streaming with my co-host and my BFF, Sandra Lopez. Hey, Sandra, how are you?
I'm excited to be back.
I know you were on vacation for a week, you lucky devil.
I know. I was a little distracted last time we spoke on the show. And this time I'm very excited. We have an excellent lineup.
Yes, and actually, it's the noise right now is Twitter going crazy, actually. I just tweeted out that we have two special guests today. And as you know, every day, new scientific studies are published showing how aging people can live healthier and longer. Yet the public almost never learns about these breakthrough findings. The tragic result is that Americans die prematurely. Joining me right now is Bill Falloon, the co-founder of Life Extension Foundation, and the foundation's medical director, Dr. Stephen Joyal. Dr. Joyal and Bill have so much to share with those who may be new to what Life Extension does. Bill, how are you today?
I'm doing good, Tanya. As you know, information is power, especially as it relates to our personal health. We at Life Extension, we want our people to know and understand their options to live longer and better, something that when the correct information is disseminated, they can fully take advantage of the underlying science.
Wow. And Bill and Dr. Joyal, I know how passionate with both you guys are about achieving optimal health and providing information to people that improve their lives. What is the inspiration for your work?
Well, the inspiration came from my early career in the mortuary field. I mean, I could have been working in the medical field, but I chose to go into a different direction to find out why so many people were dying needlessly.
And Dr. Joyal, what made you decide to get involved with Life Extension Foundation?
Well, Tanya, first of all, I have never told Bill this, but I really want to thank him for the opportunity he's given me over the years to contribute, at least in some small way, to the success of our organization. Tanya, Bill is a visionary, and his vision is to conquer aging. And I am an enthusiastic and passionate partner in that endeavor. Now, my background is in allopathic medicine, conventional medicine. I am a medical doctor, an MD. I graduated in 1993 from the Dartmouth and Brown program in medicine. I've been privileged to be in private practice as an internist, board certified in internal medicine in 1997. I've had time in the pharmaceutical industry developing life-saving medications in cardiovascular disease, obesity, and metabolic conditions, and as I alluded to in the beginning, over the past 7 years, to be participating in, I think, the most dynamic organization in the world.
Wow. Yes, I totally agree with you there. And Bill, let me ask you something. So you were in the mortuary business, and what did you learn from that, and what motivated you to start the Life Extension Foundation?
Well, what was really interesting is, I would, of course, counsel a deceased member's family, and I'd often ask a question, you know, how did this person die so young? And no matter what age they were, I always considered that they died too young. And so often the family would know what adverse lifestyle factors caused that person to die prematurely. They'd often say they weren't controlling their blood sugar properly, that they were following a poor diet, they smoked too many cigarettes. There were definitive reasons why a person would wind up in my mortuary that could have been prevented. And after doing this for over 7 years, I realized that most people today are prematurely suffering and dying from diseases that could be prevented if the right steps were taken.
So, gentlemen, let's briefly touch upon a few topics of interest to everyone interested in optimal health. And I know Sandra and I, we talk about it every Wednesday in our show. And again, before we start, I just want to say thank you so much, because usually we broadcast our show on Wednesday from 1 to 2. But I know both of you guys are very extremely busy men. And thank you so much for taking some time with us and chatting with our listeners, because we've been talking about Life Extension Foundation all these years. Amazing. And we're just thrilled that we have you both on today. So, Bill, tell me something. For example, there's so much talk about vitamin D in the news lately. I mean, like, just Like, if you Google vitamin D right now, I will guarantee you within an hour ago, someone published something about vitamin D. Can you tell us a little bit about vitamin D?
Well, what has been uncovered over the last 15 to 20 years is that vitamin D is involved in virtually every process that protects us against degenerative diseases, be it vascular disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, chronic inflammation. It seems that if we're deficient in vitamin D or have insufficient levels, we're at a greater risk for all of those disorders. And if you ever wonder why so many people contract the flu viruses and the common colds in winter months, well, one of the reasons is that they have less vitamin D in their body because there's less exposure to sunlight. So we've got concrete evidence that insufficient levels of vitamin D are predisposing people to a host of unwanted ailments. And it's such an inexpensive nutrient to take that we advocate that everybody strive to achieve optimal blood levels of vitamin D.
And what would the optimal blood level be?
Well, we at Life Extension and other experts are looking at a number of 50, that's 50 nanograms per milliliter of blood of a vitamin D metabolite called 25-hydroxy vitamin D. That's what we measure in the blood to assess vitamin D status. You want to have vitamin D levels over 50 nanograms per milliliter, which is easy to ascertain by taking a vitamin D blood test.
And Dr. Joel, can you tell us a little bit about what you, your thoughts on about vitamin D?
Of course, Tanya. As Bill related to you, the scientific research on vitamin D has literally exploded over the past several years. And at Life Extension, of course, we are copious readers of all of the data in science on breakthroughs in medicine. The data on vitamin D is very interesting, very encouraging. One of the topics Bill touched upon was the idea of maintaining optimal levels of vitamin D in the body, and the blood test, which is simple to obtain, very cost-effective, is something called a 25-hydroxy vitamin D test. And again, it's readily available, and it's low cost, and it's very important to test your body's store, your reservoir, if you will, of vitamin D. And Bill had mentioned that at a threshold minimum, based upon our evaluation of the research, as well as our close collaboration with experts in the field of vitamin D, that a baseline, a bare minimum level of 50 nanograms per milliliter does seem to be the ideal baseline range for optimal health. Let me also add a few other points, too, just talking about some of the research on vitamin D. We know, for example, that vitamin D is so important for health even beyond just bone. People think of vitamin D and they think of bone health, but there are more than 30 different cell types and tissues in the body that have vitamin D receptors. Furthermore, one of the things that we at Life Extension know is very important is that of looking at high-quality clinical studies. And high-quality clinical studies, things like randomized, controlled, placebo-controlled studies are really the gold standard. So to that point, looking at the vitamin D literature, for example, there was a study that was published a few years ago in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, again, a randomized controlled double-blind study, and it showed that women given supplemental vitamin D and calcium had a significant, statistically significant reduction in cancer risk over a four-year trial. So we know that there are very strong studies that support vitamin D and the tremendous health benefits associated with it. And I'll add one other thing as well. There was a recent study that was just published a couple days ago showing that, in fact, the best way to have blood levels of vitamin D that reach what we consider to be an optimal threshold is to take vitamin D with the heaviest or biggest meal of the day. We know that vitamin D is a fat-soluble vitamin, so, again, it makes sense that, in fact, the research does support taking vitamin D, your vitamin D supplement, with the biggest meal of the day.
You know, and I didn't know that, actually. I was taking mine first thing in the morning. But before we go, so how much vitamin D do people need it to take anyways? I was reading some people were, like, telling me, oh, you only need, like, 100 IU or something like that. But as I'm reading more into the research, it seems like Life Extension Foundations is suggesting a lot more than that.
Well, the problem is that most people will be reading favorable media reports about vitamin D reducing the risks of all kind of diseases, and they look on their multivitamin supplement label and they see it contains 400 to 600 IUs. And they're thinking, well, that sounds like a lot. I'm probably getting all the vitamin D I need. The reality is, and this is based on a 13,000 test subject study we did at Life Extension back in 2009, where we evaluated vitamin D blood levels in this large group of people who are already taking dietary supplements. And it turned out that 85% of them had insufficient levels of 25-hydroxyvitamin D in their blood. And here we had people who thought they were getting lots of vitamin D, and most of these people were taking over 1,000 IUs, but still 85% of them had insufficient vitamin D levels. And we came to the conclusion that for a typical person, they should be taking around 5,000 IUs of vitamin D every single day. And they should be taking that with the heaviest meal of the day. And that dose is most likely to get them over that minimum threshold of 50 nanograms per milliliter of 25-hydroxyvitamin D in their blood. So we have a strong basis based on a large test group. We at Life Extension, we do a lot of blood testing, and we had all these blood test results in on file. So we were able to do this study of 13,000 dedicated supplement users and found that 85% didn't have enough vitamin D. Now, since we published the findings of that study in January 2010, most of our Life Extension members are over 50 nanograms per milliliter.
Does that have any bearing on age? How old
well,
you are?
It does from the standpoint that older people don't convert sunlight into vitamin D in their bodies as readily as younger people. And older people are more sensitive to the sun. They're aware of the various skin cancer risks, so they intentionally stay out of the sun. They wear a lot of sunblock, so they're not going to get a lot of vitamin D from the most potent natural source, which is sunlight. So as a result, older people are going to need to take more supplemental vitamin D on average, especially if they're overweight or obese. The more a person weighs, often the more vitamin D they need to take.
Wow.
Tanya, if I may, if I could build on something Bill said, which I think is very important, and that is that there is a level of variability with a person's individual response to a vitamin D dose. And the 5,000 IU dose is certainly higher than what many people are accustomed to seeing, and Bill had mentioned certainly the mainstream media talking about what we would consider to be relatively inadequate or even trivial doses. But the point that I'd like to make is that when in doubt, there is a low-cost, easily obtainable blood test to rigorously assess what your 25-hydroxy-D level is. So when in doubt, obtain the blood test, and that way you'll know what your level is.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, because some people, they'll take 5,000 IUs a day, and they'll get their 25-hydroxyvitamin D blood levels higher than 100. And we don't see any value in doing that. There could be some concerns about toxicity if you go too high. Getting that blood test is real important, and then you know exactly how much you should be taking. And if you're taking too much, you wind up saving a lot of money, because you're not going to be taking for the rest of your life too much of the vitamin D supplement.
Where would you take this blood test? And Life Extension?
You can go to your doctor's office. There are commercial labs that do it. You can call Life Extension, and we can send out a requisition form so you can go into a blood draw station anywhere in the country. These tests are readily available. In the beginning, there was an accuracy concern, but the bigger laboratories that Life Extension uses and most doctors use, they have reliable results. So it's now become a almost standard test. More and more people are asking their doctors for it because they do understand that they need to maintain a minimal amount of 25-hydroxyvitamin D in their blood in order to achieve the benefits.
So if somebody decided to get themselves tested, when did they start the test? I mean, do they take the test before they start supplementing with vitamin D, or is there a protocol for that?
Well, it's kind of a waste of money to take a vitamin D test before you start supplementing because you're almost certainly going to be very low. We've seen people under 10 nanograms per milliliter of vitamin D, which is a deficient level. That's where everyone, including the federal government and conventional medicine, says you're in a danger zone. But we've seen people under 10 who don't take enough vitamin D or don't take any. So if you're not taking a couple thousand IUs of vitamin D already, don't even waste your money getting your blood tested now. Start taking about 5,000 IUs a day for 30 to 60 days, and then have your blood drawn. And that'll give you a good idea as to whether or not you've been taking enough, a little bit too much, a little bit too little. So we recommend people start the vitamin D first and then have their blood tested to assess where they really are in response to the type of dosing that we find most people need.
That's incredible, Bill. This information should be in the front of every newspaper in the world, actually. Vitamin D is so inexpensive that everyone can afford to take optimal potencies. I mean, this.
Well, we like the fact that vitamin D is probably the most inexpensive supplement out there, and it may have more documentation to validate its efficacy than virtually anything else. There are expensive nutrients, and we'd hate to tell people you need to take 10 times more to get the benefit because virtually no one could afford that. But with vitamin D, it's readily affordable to everyone, and the good news is it has more documentation validating its potential efficacy in disease prevention than perhaps any other nutrient.
Wow. And I, for some reason, I heard that vitamin D was considered a hormone, Bill.
Or Dr. Joyal could explain that. It really is a pro-hormone in the body. It's not a vitamin per se, but people call it a vitamin, so we like to keep the same nomenclature.
Tanya, Bill is correct. Vitamin D in supplement form really is a pro-hormone, and vitamin D physiology is quite fascinating. Of course, what happens, and we always need to be aware of safety, and the safety profile for vitamin D is quite good. If people have conditions like high levels of calcium in their blood, or if they have kidney disease, they should check with their healthcare practitioner, but elaborating a little bit on the physiology, what happens when you take a vitamin D supplement is it's absorbed and it first goes to the liver and then it undergoes a biochemical step called hydroxylation. And I know this is a little bit of terminology, but our members are very intelligent, so I know that they'll appreciate this information. It undergoes hydroxylation to that 25-hydroxy vitamin D form. That is the same form that is measured in the blood test. And then it goes to the kidney where it undergoes another hydroxylation step to form 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. That 1,25-dihydroxy form is a truly metabolically active form. Now there's something else too. Of course, we always want to be safe and safety is always paramount in our mind at our organization. To that point, the 25-hydroxy-D form is really a storage form. This is how I look at it and how I explain it to people. The 1,25-dihydroxy form is the very metabolically active form. The great news is that enzyme, that hydroxylase enzyme in the kidney, is very tightly controlled. And so what that means is that there's a great safety margin here for people. So again, if I can emphasize one main point, which is, if people are concerned about their vitamin D level, and they should be, they need to get a blood test, and they should obviously start supplementing too. To Bill's point, a vast majority of people that we see are at insufficient levels, and many are frankly deficient as well.
Wow, that's some credit. And you know what? As we're, while we're on the show, and this just came out, vitamin D3 boost hair grown stem cell. I mean, I've just watched all this stuff across Google. Vitamin D3 helps with weight loss. I mean, stop me if I'm wrong. Some of these claims that they're this is coming across my screen as we're chatting about this. Weight loss, prostate cancer. Now I just saw one for hair growing stem cells. I mean, why isn't everyone in America or in the world beyond this fantastic supplement?
Well, it's interesting. If you're overweight and all you do is take a vitamin D supplement, it's not going to really help you lose weight. But if you combine it with a science-based weight management program that includes just a lot of different components to defeat the aging-related weight gain that so many people encounter, vitamin D becomes an important component because it helps suppress inflammatory reactions. And unfortunately, weight gain and inflammation, they go hand in hand. So a critical component of a weight loss program is to suppress the inflammatory fires in your body, and that can help facilitate weight loss in conjunction with reduced calorie intake, increased physical activity, and different types of hormones, drugs, nutrients that can inhibit some of the factors that are involved in age-associated weight gain, which most of us suffer from. And unfortunately, people try to go on a diet, and that's like one part of the whole overall program, and they may lose some weight. It rapidly comes back on. So vitamin D, though, does have this multiple beneficial factor profile that you don't see with a whole lot of other nutrients.
And since we're talking about inflammation, I mean, a lot of things, I hear a lot nowadays about omega-3 fatty acid. Can we touch a little bit about that and what your thoughts are?
Well, chronic inflammation is something that people encounter as they age, as they accumulate excess weight, their C-reactive protein levels in their blood, which is a measurement of systemic inflammation, starts to increase. And people with higher C-reactive protein levels have much greater risks of stroke, heart attacks, cancers, Alzheimer's. Inflammation literally tears us apart. Fish oil, which contains the omega-3 fatty acids, is a way to reduce the chronic inflammatory process in the body. And fish oil has become very popular because that's another nutrient that's received a lot of favorable media coverage. And when the newspapers and the news broadcasters on TV start to extol the virtues of a dietary supplement, people then believe it. They say, well, now that's all true. We know that fish oil is effective. Well, in reality, Life Extension knew 25 years ago that if people took in more omega-3 fatty acids from cold water fish or from certain plant foods, that they would reduce inflammatory reactions in the body, that they would reduce their risk of coronary events that would predispose them to heart attacks and cerebrovascular events that would predispose them to stroke. So tremendous data out there on the omega-3s. I think people understand that. Fish oil sales are at an all-time high across the board. People are taking fish oil supplements more than they ever did, and they're looking at cold water fish as part of their regular diet to make sure that they get enough of those omega-3s.
So, Bill, I receive a lot of questions from my listeners about omega-3 fats also, and they always ask me about the food that contains omega-3 fats, and we mentioned, salmon and everything, but what about the walnuts? There was a big scandal about walnuts recently with the FDA, but can we tell a little bit about the walnuts?
Well, walnuts are a great way to get a precursor to the EPA and DHA found in fish oil. Walnuts contain the alpha-linolenic acid, and people who eat a lot of walnuts have sharply lowered rates of heart attack and stroke and other degenerative diseases. So walnuts are great to get in these essential fatty acids, including the precursor to the omega-3 EPA DHA. Trouble with walnuts is, of course, they have a high fat content. And while if you use walnuts as a meal replacement, nothing wrong with that. But if you decide to snack on walnuts because you feel you're getting some beneficial omega-3 precursors, problem is you're taking in too many fat calories. And you may start gaining some unwanted weight. So you've got to be careful about the sources you choose for your omega-3 when it comes to dietary sources. Now, flaxseed is a good one. Flaxseed can be sprinkled on cereal. Some people take flaxseed oil. So that's a vegetarian way of obtaining the omega-3s without having to eat the fish. But again, the ideal way to get in the EPA and DHA, which are the omega-3s responsible for the best documented disease prevention, is to either eat the cold water fish on a consistent basis or take the fish oil supplements.
So not too many people can eat that much food to get that supplement, so they have the supplementation. But what can we identify as a quality supplement? What criteria do we need to follow? Dr. Joyelle, can you give us a little info about that?
Yes, Tanya, that's a very important question. At Life Extension, we take quality very, very seriously. And as we're often fond of saying, it's not just what's in your supplement, it's what's not in your supplement. And this is particularly germane to fish oil supplements. Specifically, if you go out and you buy a piece of salmon or tuna, is another example, tuna is a predatory fish, and as a predatory fish in the food chain, heavy metals and other contaminants like dioxins and PCBs tend to build up in that fish. In this case, it's tuna. So one of the things that I think is very important to understand with a quality fish oil supplement is having it analyzed and evaluated by an objective third-party analytical lab to test for purity. Now, what this means is that the lab will use things like advanced analytical techniques, high-performance liquid chromatography, also known as HPLC, or mass spectrometry, also known as mass spec. These are analytical methods that use highly advanced scientific techniques to test products, in this case fish oil, for those types of contaminants I mentioned. Heavy metals, things like cadmium, arsenic, lead, PCBs, and dioxins. And what we've recognized as a superior testing organization is IFOS. IFOS stands for International Fish Oil Standard. And what I would strongly recommend to your listeners is if they're looking at a fish oil product, make sure that it has a five-star IFOS, International Fish Oil Standards rating. That is, again, an objective organization that tests fish oil products for rigorous standards of purity and potency.
Would that be labeled on the bottle or box?
Some organizations and manufacturers of products do that.
Mm-hmm.
If people have any questions, they can also go to the International Fish Oil Standards website where they list products along with ratings.
That's fantastic. Thank you for letting me know that. Because I know it's very important for people to know information, especially high quality fish oil supplement, and you know, especially if they're investing in their health and everything. But let's step back a little bit. I want to chat a little bit about some other things that Life Extension Foundation had talked about, especially the ones that you have discovered 10, 20, 30 years ago. And at that time, back then, not too many people believed in you, and especially the FDA. Can we just go down a little bit of memory lane what Life Extension Foundation discovered and shared with their members, and then fast forward to today where it's actually coming out mainstream? Especially, like, for example, vitamin D?
Well, one of the more controversial areas that we introduced to medicine was the use of low-dose aspirin in the prevention of heart attack. Life Extension did that back in 1983, and we were ridiculed by quite a few people for insinuating that something as simple as low-dose aspirin could reduce the risk of heart attack. And subsequent to our recommendation that people consider aspirin, lots and lots of studies came out, and yet the FDA refused to recognize this validated data. And we had to battle the FDA for 15 years to convince them that low-dose aspirin, indeed, in certain patients, had a significant reducing effect of heart attack and ischemic stroke. As studies continued to go on, it was proven that if a person had a first heart attack and they got on low-dose aspirin, they had a dramatic reduction in their risk of a second heart attack. And other studies showed that people with certain cardiac risk factors, if they were on low-dose aspirin, their risk of heart attack was substantially reduced. Now, what Life Extension has been looking into over the last 5 years is the ability of low-dose aspirin to potentially reduce cancer risk. We've got some data right now that looks solid, and we're continuing to evaluate it, showing that people who take low-dose aspirin every day may reduce their overall cancer risk by 30%. And what we're studying is whether or not the specific mechanisms by which low-dose cancer may reduce cancer risk is also conferred by the nutrients that most of our members are taking, such as curcumin and green tea, pycnogenol, milk thistle extract. It may very well be that our members are getting the antiplatelet effects of aspirin with the plant-based nutrients that they're taking. And it's the antiplatelet benefits of aspirin that seem to not only reduce the risk of a coronary artery blockage or a cerebral artery blockage, but also induce apoptosis of cancer cells in the body. And if you can cause cancer cells that are forming to self-destruct, which is what apoptosis is, you can prevent cancer. So we're looking at some very exciting research right now. But I would say back to 1983, if people adhere to some of our recommendations, especially the one relating to low-dose aspirin, there'd be a lot of people alive today who are currently residing in cemeteries.
Wow. And what year did the FDA finally say that they agree that to take low level of low dosage or aspirin? Didn't they just Bill? When did you discover aspirin? What year did Life Extension come out
with it? Well, it's 1983 that we published data.
Okay.
That was really supported by a number of existing scientific studies showing that aspirin would have this antiplatelet effect, and in doing so, it would reduce the risk of the formation of an abnormal blood clot forming in a coronary artery. That's what causes most heart attacks, is that a blood clot blocks blood flow to a portion of the heart muscle, and it can cause a sudden death heart attack or just a mild heart attack where you have to undergo stenting or bypass.
Mm-hmm.
By having an antiplatelet ingredient in your body throughout the day, and that antiplatelet ingredient could be green tea, it could be curcumin, it could be grapeseed extract, resveratrol, but it also may be the antiplatelet effect of aspirin is what most people need to reduce the risk of heart attack and ischemic stroke. So we've got a lot of good data to substantiate that. And in 1998, the FDA recognized the role of aspirin in secondary cardiac prevention. And right now, it's just accepted. Most cardiologists will put any kind of patient who's suspected as having a risk factor for a heart attack on low-dose aspirin. But we had to battle the FDA. We even came out with a product called First Amendment Aspirin, where we stated on the label the scientific evidence documenting its ability to reduce heart attack risk. And the FDA went to great lengths to remove that product from the market and even threaten us with incarceration.
Wow, just for saving lives. Imagine that. Okay, so Bill, let me ask you some other questions too. I wanted to talk a little bit about diabetes because it's something that's really close to our heart at all time. But I feel like the disease that caused heart disease that mainstream doctors overlook, it seems like one of them is diabetes. Isn't diabetes pretty close to heart disease and Alzheimer? I mean, it's having too much sugar.
Well, one scientist in a study he published equated type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes either way as being analogous to having heart disease, because virtually all diabetics are suffering accelerated atherosclerosis, and the risk factors are so high for a vascular event that if you are type 2 diabetic, you have to be exceptionally careful to make sure that all of your cardiac risk markers are kept under control. But unfortunately, unfortunately, if you are diabetic, your greatest chance of dying is that of suffering a heart attack.
Mm. Wow. So, and also, besides that, I mean, I'm reading a lot about diabetes and Alzheimer's.
Oh, absolutely. When you have uncontrolled glucose levels, you're creating havoc throughout your body. You're creating chronic inflammation, as we discussed earlier. So you're going to damage your brain cells. You're going to greatly increase your risk of different senility problems, kidney failure. You're going to, of course, have all kind of problems controlling your weight. You're going to suffer mental depression. I mean, type 2 diabetes is a horrific illness, and it's undertreated. Doctors prescribe certain drugs that partially work. They don't emphasize a proper diet as aggressively as they should, and they overlook a lot of effective therapies that could help people better control their glycemic index. Their blood levels, unfortunately, of glucose fluctuate so wildly that even if they have a fasting glucose, it's okay. Their after-meal glucose levels often are sky high, and they walk around in a state of hyperglycemia most of the day, and yet when they fast for a blood test, they're not quite as high as what a doctor might deem as being serious.
So what about strokes, Bill? Let's talk about strokes.
Well, it's one of the more preventable causes of disability and death out there. I mean, stroke causes more disability than anything else, where you have people confined to nursing homes for sometimes the last decade of their life merely because they didn't take some steps to reduce their risk of stroke. And hypertension, high blood pressure, is a leading cause. And we recommend blood pressure to average about 115 over 75. That's what we at Life Extension recommend. Conventional doctors, though, they'll look at blood pressure readings of 139 over 89, and they'll say, you're normal. And they're absolutely correct. An aging person with high blood pressure is normal. And it's also very normal for an aging person to suffer a stroke. So what we try to do with Life Extension is recommend people have an at-home blood pressure monitoring device and test their blood pressure throughout the day. Try to get to an average level of about 115 over 75. That's going to put them at an optimal range to reduce their risk not only of stroke, but of heart attack and kidney failure and so many of the other chronic illnesses that are brought on by hypertension. And there's just so many ways to lower blood pressure that nobody should be suffering from chronic hypertension without taking some aggressive actions against it.
So can you suggest some way to reduce?
Well, to reduce stroke risk, we look at some factors that go beyond just the hypertension. We look at the homocysteine, mm-hmm. We look at fibrinogen, and we look at C-reactive protein. Those three components in the blood, if any one of them is elevated, your risk of stroke increases. If all of them are elevated, you have a substantially increased risk of stroke. So as far as reducing stroke risk, and by the way, most people, as they grow older, they fear stroke more than they do heart attack. They feel a heart attack, if they have one, well, maybe it can be treated with a stent or bypass, or maybe it will just kill them right away, whereas a stroke, that so often results in paralysis. Yeah. And their quality of life is so poor, many of them would really rather not continue living. And yet they don't control their blood pressure adequately, and they ignore homocysteine, fibrinogen, and C-reactive protein in their blood. They ignore it because their conventional doctors aren't prescribing blood tests for those three key ingredients. We at Life Extension have recommended testing for homocysteine going as far back as 1981. And fibrinogen, we found evidence in 1996 as to how that dramatically increases stroke risk. C-reactive protein in the late 1990s, it was apparent that if you have chronic inflammation in your body, well, you're going to have all kind of medical problems. You want to take steps to suppress that chronic inflammation. And C-reactive protein is a marker that you can use to see if what you're doing is really reducing your chronic inflammation. In other words, if your C-reactive protein is high, you want to increase your intake of fish oil. You may want to take a low-dose aspirin. You want to take lots of curcumin. You want to take some gamma tocopherol, vitamin E. There's a number of nutrients and drugs and even hormones that can reduce C-reactive protein levels. The conventional doctors seem to overlook that, and unfortunately, their patients are suffering what they're supposed to be suffering as they age, which is stroke and heart attack and arthritis and senility. All of these disorders related to chronic inflammation, they're not being adequately addressed.
Well, Bill, I am the perfect example of understand what C-reactive protein is because, you know, I read Life Extension magazine cover to cover every month. But I remember about 5 years ago, I got really ill, and then I got my blood work done, and I went to the doctor, and the nurse practitioner that was there, she didn't know what I was talking about, the C-reactive protein. I was going, why is this so high? I know I'm getting better, but what's wrong with me with this? And she did not know what C-reactive protein. The reason I'm bringing this up is, could it be that conventional medicine weren't really taught or really focused on C-reactive protein as a marker?
Oh, well, Dr. Joyal can let me know what he learned in medical school about C-reactive protein. I mean, he graduated, I think, 1992 from Brown and Dartmouth, but were they talking about that back in 1992, Dr. Joyal?
You know what, Dr. Joyal just got kicked off the call. I'm going to have to, like, let me call him back. But, you know...
Well, let me say that it was really the late 1990s that the evidence about C-reactive protein was coming into the scientific literature, and we jumped on that rather quickly, but the mainstream doctors didn't. Now, some of them do. There's some progressive cardiologists out there, and we have a lot of respect for them. I mean, they're as mainstream as you can get, but they're also intelligent enough to recognize the dangers of chronic inflammation and how that damages blood vessel walls. So they're testing their patients' blood for C-reactive protein, and if it's elevated, they're recommending steps to reduce it. And by the way, the easiest way to reduce elevated C-reactive protein is to lose weight. As we accumulate excess fat in our body, our C-reactive protein levels do go up.
And so, because of the high level of glucose, so, I mean, there's a large body of published scientific research documents that people with higher after-meal glucose spikes have sharply increased risk of a lot of the disease, such as Alzheimer's, kidney failure, aging, cancer. So let's talk about some other suggestion that Life Extension has talked about to their members about lowering their blood glucose level.
How do they reduce that?
What we've been recommending people do, and this is pretty simple, we've always recommended people, I should have always been doing since the early 1990s, they ask their doctor for a prescription drug called metformin, which is approved to treat type 2 diabetes. But if you're not even a diabetic, but your sugar levels are increasing, we recommend you get on the metformin. Side effect profile is virtually nil if you do it the right way. And there's compelling evidence right now that metformin reduces one's risk of contracting cancer. There's even documentation right now showing that metformin would be an effective adjuvant therapy in the treatment of cancer. The three studies came out recently showing that metformin directly kills cancer stem cells. And that's one of the problems that oncologists are faced with when they're treating cancer. You know, a typical tumor, if it's hit with the right chemo drug, you'll kill off most of those cancer cells in that tumor. But the cancer stem cells, which are not rapidly dividing, are not readily killed by chemotherapy, and they'll start producing new cancer cells that are highly resistant to the chemo that killed the primary cancer cells in that initial tumor. So we're looking heavily at metformin, and we're even funding some studies where we're using metformin along with conventional cancer drugs to see if we cannot affect a better outcome by incorporating metformin in the treatment of cancer. And if metformin, which is non-toxic for virtually everybody, can work so well in the treatment of cancer, think of how well it may prevent cancer. But as far as keeping blood sugar levels down without using a prescription drug, a green coffee bean extract has an active ingredient in it called chlorogenic acid, and that inhibits enzymes in the body that cause the excess production of glucose in our liver. And that's one of the main problems aging people face. They may be on a carbohydrate-restricted diet, and they still have glucose levels that are too high. But if they take the green coffee bean extract before meals, they can reduce their after-meal glucose surge by as much as 32%.
So they can just, but they can't just drink a lot of black coffee and get the same effect?
Well, if they want to drink about 12 cups of black coffee a day, they would get the same effect. That's pretty hard to do for most people, so some people can do it. There are some polyphenol-enriched coffees now where you may get the benefits of 12 cups of coffee, maybe in just four. So there's some specialized coffees that are recognizing the benefits of the chlorogenic acid, and they're enriching the coffee with more, so people get the benefits of drinking higher amounts of coffee without having to drink so much. Because for me personally, I just can't drink coffee at all. The caffeine is too much for me. Yeah. I get burning in my stomach. I'm just not a coffee drinker, but I can sure take a green coffee bean extract capsule before every meal. That's easy. And I'd like to think I'm getting those benefits that the coffee drinkers are getting.
I started taking, I love it. You know, but I want to just, I just ran across this article on and it just got published actually July 5th, about metformin. It says that metformin may repair stroke injured brains.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, when a person suffers an ischemic injury, that's a loss of blood flow to the brain, there's going to be a lot of damage caused by the glucose, the insulin, and metformin is going to help reduce the glucose, so it's going to help reduce that kind of damage. But metformin also promotes energy metabolism within the cells. It does it by activating a molecule called AMPK, that's adenosine monophosphate protein kinase. And by doing that, it enhances the ability of cells to survive, and it also induces cells to behave in normal patterns as opposed to converting into a malignant type state. If it's possible to get Dr. Joyal back, we'd always like to hear from him on these issues.
Yes. Hold on 2 seconds. Actually, you know what? I'm going to shoot him an email because we got disconnected. I was against into everything you were saying, but hold on 2 seconds. And
got a little excited.
Yeah, I got excited. I love hearing. This is awesome. And as we're trying to get a hold of Dr. Joyal,
it's really awesome to have these experts and, you know, professionals that, you know, are really going after what
any contraindications.
Sorry about that, Bill. I'm trying to get Dr. Joyal on, but I think we just got kicked off again. So I'm just going to email him. To get him back
that's
on the show again?
I think we're having a nice conversation, but we always like to have Dr. Joyal in. He provides so much insight.
Yeah.
And he's done so much for us, by the way, as an organization, to be able to bring him on board as we did about 7 years ago. And others, we've boosted our scientific staff in-house. We have a large outside scientific advisory board at Life Extension where we get incredible insight. In fact, the knowledge about the low levels of vitamin D, that was first presented to us by one of the oncologists that we work closely with. He was using vitamin D as an adjuvant cancer treatment. He was testing his cancer patient's blood, and he wasn't getting the levels of vitamin D that he was seeking. And he thought maybe the supplements were defective. And I said, I don't think that's the problem. And we kept experimenting with different programs. And it turned out that people weren't able to achieve those ultimate levels of vitamin D with a couple thousand IUs. This oncologist found that his cancer patients needed about 8,000 IUs of vitamin D3 each day to achieve those vitamin D blood levels of over 50 nanograms per milliliter. So it's those insights that we at Life Extension get by interacting with clinicians who are out there in the field practicing medicine, with scientists who are working in the research laboratories. This is what gives us an advantage as far as disseminating information that people aren't going to read in Time magazine or in their newspaper. because it's just not discussed by typical reporters. They wait until some prestigious organization publishes a study, and then they might report on it. Often they don't, and the reason is there's so many good studies coming out nowadays that you just get a very tiny percentage of the very important health information that's being published if you rely on the mainstream media. All we do at Life Extension is study both the published data. We go to scientific conferences to hear what researchers and clinicians are describing as far as benefits they're seeing. And that's one of the ways we found out about a drug called cimetidine. That's also known as Tagamet. The heartburn medication has an interesting side effect. Cancer patients who are prescribed cimetidine have greatly improved survival. A study published in the British Journal of Cancer in 2002 gave one group of colon cancer patients 800 milligrams of cimetidine every night for a year, and then the control group got nothing. They didn't get any cimetidine. And after a 10-year period, there was a 69% improvement in survival patients getting the cimetidine compared to the ones who didn't. So if you contract colon cancer, of course, you don't die from the cancer being in your colon. You die because it metastasizes to your liver and your lungs. And the cimetidine has anti-metastatic properties. It has immune-enhancing properties. So it's been shown to work in other types of cancers. The Lancet published a study back in 1994. And we are talking about a long time ago, you understand. Back in 1994, The Lancet published a study showing that cimetidine improved overall cancer survival by about 83%. So we've got some rather significant data published in prestigious medical journals that the oncologists, for the most part, are overlooking, and they're not reported in mainstream media.
Bill, hold on a second, okay? I'm going to... Dr. Joya, I'm sorry we actually kicked you off the line.
That's okay.
Sorry about that. But, Bill, we were just Dr. Joya, we were just talking about cimetidine and its awesome effects. But Bill, let me ask you something. Cimetidine is you say is Tagamet. Can we just go to CVS or any of the drugstore, any store to buy it?
Oh, that's the great thing about cimetidine. It's still sold under the brand name Tagamet. You'll spend more money if you buy it Tagamet. But yeah, you can go to your 7-Eleven. You can go to your grocery store, your pharmacy. You can buy cimetidine over the counter. And you should certainly let your oncologist know that you're doing this, but the typical dose that they were using in the clinical studies showing these remarkable improvements in survival was 800 milligrams taken each night of cimetidine for about a year. In one study, they started the cimetidine 5 days before surgery and then continued it 1 year afterwards. And that's where they were able to show that 69% improvement in survival over a 10-year period in the group getting the cimetidine compared to the group not getting it. It just makes a lot of sense for most cancers, and this is a wide range of cancers, to be using cimetidine. It improves your T helper to T suppressor cell ratio, and in doing so, you turn on active constituents in your immune system that are sometimes turned off by cancer. I mean, cancer wants to thrive, so it does not like your T helper cells attacking it, and it will sometimes cause the overexpression of T suppressor cells in your body to turn off your immune system. Cimetidine turns on those T helper cells and suppresses the T suppressor cells that are meant to turn off immune function.
Wow, and you know, the average Americans or average people don't know about this at all.
No. Well, they don't. The good news is if they really want to pay attention to this, they can go onto the National Library of Medicine's database and just type in cimetidine and cancer. And what they'll see is over 100 studies that support the use of cimetidine against certain forms of cancer. The information is there. It's freely accessible. Nowadays, most people have a computer. They can log right onto Google. Find the National Library of Medicine's website, and they can read for themselves the data that substantiates the use of cimetidine in the adjuvant treatment of cancer. It's not something you use by itself, by the way, but you use it with other cancer medications, and the results are astounding.
That's incredible. I'm still like, are you in shock
yet, Tanya?
Yeah, we're kind of like, so tell us more.
I'm dumbfounded.
Yeah, we're kind of like, we're in awe right now.
what the problem is, the public just doesn't understand that there are more therapies available than what the mainstream medicine normally prescribes. A lot of reasons for this. Cimetidine, metformin, aspirin, they're no longer covered by patents. So there's no pharmaceutical company out there promoting them. You won't see them advertised on TV. You won't have sales reps going to doctor's offices telling them about the studies. So unfortunately, they kind of fall off the radar screen. Doesn't mean they don't work anymore. It's just they're not publicized anymore. But when a patient contracts a cancer and they're looking for a more effective way to treat it, those three drugs that I mentioned, aspirin, metformin, and cimetidine, may be very effective for their particular form of cancer. And they can validate that by doing their own research on the medical databases or having some other people do that research for them. But we're funding a study right now where we're going to be treating advanced pancreatic cancer patients, and we will be using metformin and aspirin and curcumin and a number of the nutrients that people are taking right now. We're going to be using that in addition to conventional chemotherapy. And we're hoping to induce some complete responses, some improvements in survival. Of course, the ultimate objective is a cure. But when it comes to pancreatic cancer, virtually no one is ever cured of that. But we're putting in about 35 different ingredients into this cocktail to experimentally treat advanced pancreatic cancer. And if it works, we could take someone who maybe only has a six-month lifespan projection and extend that by a number of years.
It sounds like life extension is getting closer and closer to the cure.
These
are experimental studies. These are, of course, clinical studies, though. I mean, these are real humans who have pancreatic cancer, and the typical drug used to treat pancreatic cancer is gemcitabine, and that can improve survival by a couple months. It's a relatively low toxicity drug, but they did a study just 2 years ago where they gave three different chemotherapy drugs to pancreatic cancer patients, and they more than doubled the survival compared to the low toxicity gemcitabine, but unfortunately those three drugs induced a lot of side effects. But what that study showed is that if you hit cancer with different weapons and not rely on the single agent, you have a much better chance of extending lifespan or potentially affecting a cure.
Oh, thank you for that information, Bill. There's some other stuff I wanted to touch base, too. We're going to go a little bit over our hour, and that's okay. I think a lot of our listeners are very excited about this, especially all the information we're getting. Let's talk a bit about calcification. I mean, we were like talking about calcification, the meaning of it. Can you tell me a little bit of information about calcification?
Well, as humans age, they accumulate calcium in their soft tissues, which is where they don't want it to be. Calcium, of course, you want it in your bone to maintain healthy density, so you don't develop osteoporosis and fracture as you grow older. Unfortunately, as we grow older, and this is very normal, calcium starts to accumulate in the inner linings of our arteries, in our heart valves, in our brain cells. We literally turn to stone as we age. But there's a nutrient that people can take that would block the infiltration of calcium into our soft tissues. And that nutrient is vitamin K2. It's something that's rather difficult to get in our diet, but it can be taken as a low-cost supplement. And by taking the vitamin K2 every day, we literally block the excess infiltration of calcium into our arterial lining, into our aortic valve and other heart valves, and we can reduce that rate of calcification so that does not become one of the causes of death. It's a major cause of atherosclerosis, by the way. A fascinating study was done in Europe where they evaluated vitamin K intake, and those with the highest intake of vitamin K2 were 57% less likely to suffer a cardiovascular event. they were 52% less likely to suffer aortic stenosis, which is a major problem as people get older. The aortic valve in their heart starts to become occluded with calcium, and it closes down, and they need surgery, and that surgery itself has all kind of complications. And in fact, this study showed that people with the highest vitamin K2 intake were 26% less likely to die from anything. So we have a nutrient out there that can inhibit calcification of our soft tissues and at the same time keep calcium in our bone where you want it. And people, unfortunately, are not aware of vitamin K the way they are of vitamin D nowadays. Vitamin K hasn't quite hit the mainstream. So people, for the most part, are ignorant of its vital importance.
So vitamin K2, like you said, like I really didn't know much about it until, like, I guess a year ago. I started reading one of the article that you had written about vitamin K2. But nowadays, I mean, it's, you still don't hear about this. What do you predict about the mainstream media will pick up on this? I mean, it took them, what, how many years for them to figure out vitamin D and aspirin? So
close to 20.
Well, yeah, it took decades for them to figure out the aspirin and the vitamin D. It took them quite a while. I don't know when the breakthrough study will occur that will cause the media to say this is worthy of our attention. Life Extension started recommending vitamin K in 1999. There was persuasive evidence starting in the 1990s that vitamin K was essential to preventing this pathological calcification that's going to occur in all of us if we don't do something about it. It's just one of those problems that nature doesn't really have an internal protective mechanism. We need to have the vitamin K2 in our blood to block that infiltration of calcium into our soft tissues. And the studies are overwhelmingly positive, and they're overwhelmingly consistent that those who take higher amounts of vitamin K2 are protecting themselves against arteriosclerosis, against the valvular calcification, against some of the calcification that can shut down brain cells, kidney cells, and yet it hasn't made it into the mainstream yet. There was a concern that people, if they took too much vitamin K, might overcoagulate. They might produce abnormal blood clots, but that was refuted. You cannot take too much vitamin K. It's not going to cause hypercoagulation. So we know it's safe, and we know everybody should be taking it, and yet very few people are.
And so if you already have blocked arteries already, so is there anything we can do about that? Is there any
to reverse the calcification process, we don't know yet. Vitamin K might help a little bit, but it's probably not going to reverse systemic calcification to the degree people need it. There's going to be some studies coming out, or results of studies coming out about chelation therapy, which theoretically would reverse calcification, but we're not certain that really works.
And what about pomegranate?
Well, what excited us so much about the pomegranate is its ability to reverse the blockage in arteries that was occurring with aging. A study was done with people who had, let's say, reduced blood flow through their carotid arteries. Those would be arteries in the neck that feed the brain. And that's called carotid stenosis, when the arteries start to narrow, they become calcified. And they did an interesting study with two groups of people. One group was given the standard medical therapy, and the other group was given the standard medical therapy, which included maybe some statin drugs and antihypertensives, but they added pomegranate to that group. And after a year, there was a 35% reduction in the carotid stenosis in the group getting the pomegranate plus the standard medical therapy compared to the group getting only standard medical therapy. That group had a 9% worsening of the carotid stenosis. And by one measurement of blood flow, they were able to show about a 40% improvement of more blood going to the brain in the group getting the pomegranate compared to the one only getting the standard drugs. So we at Life Extension, we heavily endorse the use of pomegranate juice. Just 8 ounces a day of pomegranate juice was used in that study, and it produced those remarkable results. for people who don't want to drink the juice, because of course it does have sugar, it's going to add some calories to your diet, there are pomegranate extract supplements where you can take some pomegranate capsules and get the active ingredients in the juice and get the same nutrients in your body that you would with a pomegranate juice. So we've been proponents of pomegranate for a number of years, and it's another one of those nutrients that hasn't quite hit the mainstream the way it should have. There were some published articles in mainstream media when the studies came out on pomegranate, but you know, after a day or two, they disappear, and people forget that those studies exist. But we, through our Live Attention magazine, try to remind our members, drink your pomegranate juice every day or take your pomegranate supplement, because you're going to potentially be able to reverse some of the effects of atherosclerosis that up until recently people thought was impossible.
Well, that's incredible. So I don't really, I just went to the doctor and he didn't tell me to look into pomegranate.
How many
doctors actually say that to their patient?
We don't really know. The doctors nowadays are recommending fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
They're recommending sometimes folic acid. They're slowly catching up, and I would say the progressive ones are recommending the pomegranate, by the way, and they should, because it's really interesting how pomegranate works in the body. I mean, how can we reverse atherosclerosis? Well, pomegranate improves the efficacy of HDL, high-density lipoprotein, or HDL, is the carrier protein that removes cholesterol from the arterial wall, brings it back to the liver for safe disposal. And HDL, as we get older, it becomes less efficient. Pomegranate improves the efficacy of HDL in removing cholesterol and other plaque buildup from the arterial wall and getting it out of the body through the liver detoxification mechanism. So we've got a really safe nutrient that people can take. They can, again, buy it in the grocery store. They can buy the supplements in the health food store, and they can have a remarkable reversal of indicators of atherosclerosis. And yet, the progressive cardiologist may be mentioning it. I fear, for the most part, it's overlooked.
See, that's, again, I'm just saying that the average doctors are not saying this, and I'm so thrilled. And again, thank you for coming on and letting us know about this information. But before we go, I just want to talk a little bit about, you came up with, you wrote a book called Pharmocracy. And actually, I read it page to page, actually, cover to cover. And it was, and you pointed out a lot of failure on the FDA part. But tell us a little bit about the book, Pharmocracy.
You know, I was compelled, personally, to write that book, Pharmocracy, to enlighten the public about why medical progress is so slow. You look at the information technologies, be it the iPhones, your personal computers, your ability to communicate long distance, how quickly that technology has evolved, whereas in the medical field, it hasn't. And yet, in the scientific arena, all kinds of breakthroughs are occurring. We're discovering all kinds of ways to potentially prevent and treat disease, but they're not making it into the clinical arena. So patients who need life-saving therapies, they're being denied. And one reason is an antiquated regulatory structure where we have a Food and Drug Administration that is incapable of evaluating new technologies to ascertain whether or not they should be approved. And the result is, Americans are suffering and dying from diseases that are potentially curable if it were not for the roadblock erected by the FDA. You know, one of the examples that I can give is the drug we talked about earlier today, metformin. That was approved in England in 1958. It was then approved throughout Europe, Canada, and subsequent years. It took until 1995 for the FDA to approve metformin in the United States. That was a 37-year delay in approving a medication that's acknowledged by everyone as being highly effective in the treatment of type 2 diabetes, and now we've seen it being potentially effective in the treatment of cancer, the prevention of cancer, and yet it may never be approved for that reason because there's no patent on it. So we have a bureaucratic barrier called the FDA that's standing in the way of medical progress. So I wrote the book Pharmocracy to enlighten the American public about the fact that there could be quicker developments of more effective medications and safer medications, because in this bureaucratic quagmire that we exist in, dangerous drugs such as Vioxx and Bextra and Avandia and Trazodone, drugs that have cumulatively killed hundreds of thousands of Americans, those drugs got approved. And yet drugs that are safe and highly effective, ribavirin is one that we talk about. It's a broad-spectrum antiviral medication. It doubles efficacy in treating hepatitis C when combined with alpha interferon. Life Extension recommended that back in 1983. FDA didn't approve that until around 1998. And we think of all the hepatitis C patients who needlessly died, and all the people who were infected with various viruses, influenza, who could have used ribavirin to cure their disease, and instead they perished. So Pharmocracy was written to enlighten the public about the fact we need to change the regulatory structure in this country in order to get better medications available sooner.
But, you know, that makes me upset just to think of how many lives could have been saved.
Well, anyone listening to this program who's, I guess, over a certain age knows of people who suffered type 2 diabetes, and metformin is considered by everyone to be the first-line treatment. It's the safest and most effective way to treat early-stage type 2 diabetes, and yet Americans were denied access to that drug for 37 years. There's literally millions of type 2 diabetic Americans who were suffering and then died prematurely because they weren't able to access a drug that was being used throughout Europe and Canada.
And it's so easy for FDA to prove, I mean, they're making it harder to approve a drug, but how long does it take them to actually admit that they made a mistake of approving a drug?
Well, like they violence. Never really do admit the mistake. They'll blame it on the pharmaceutical company. They never really take blame themselves. There is corruption in the drug approval process. Pharmaceutical companies will conduct fraudulent studies. They'll cover up data showing a drug is dangerous and then deceive the FDA. But the FDA themselves will often ignore evidence that a drug has lethal side effects. You look at the drug Avandia approved to treat type 2 diabetes. As we discussed, a heart attack is the greatest complication that a type 2 diabetic faces. And yet the side effect of Avandia was to increase heart attack risk. So we had a situation where diabetics were taking a drug to lower their blood sugar, but unfortunately it increased the risk of having a heart attack, the very disease that they were most in fear of being type 2 diabetics. So we unfortunately have this problem with a number of drugs that the FDA approved to treat a condition such as Paxil to alleviate depression, and its side effect was to increase suicidal thinking by 6.7 times.
Wow.
People were literally committing suicide by taking a drug approved to treat depression. It doesn't make any sense. The company making it covered up the fact that more people taking Paxil were having suicidal thoughts than not taking Paxil. They're paying some record-breaking fines right now because of that, but that doesn't bring back the people who took the drug and unfortunately committed suicide.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking about, all the different people that we could have saved.
All I can remember is how many commercials were on TV
about
Paxil. Take Paxil. Paxil.
Yeah,
they're
depressed. All the commercials made you want to take Paxil whether you're depressed or not.
Yeah.
You were supposed to feel better. Unfortunately, if you were a smart depressed person, you'd take it and say, I'm feeling really bad. I'm going to stop taking this drug. Unfortunately, psychiatrists sometimes pressure their patients. They say, you may not feel good in the beginning, but just keep taking this for the next 30 to 90 days. And compliant patients, which all doctors want, compliant patients, they keep taking the drug, they keep feeling worse, and finally they wind up ending their own life. And it's an absolute tragedy. And it's just so immoral that the drug company knew about these increased suicidal thoughts and people taking Paxil and other antidepressants, and yet they covered them up. They kind of waited until the patent expired, and then they sent apology letters out to doctors saying, you know, that drug you're prescribing for the last 17 years, turns out it was probably worsening your patient's conditions, and we just want to let you know about it so you don't continue prescribing it. Of course, that's after the patent expired. It's now a generic. They don't make money on it anymore. So this is the world we're living in right now. And in Life Extension, we're determined to do our small or large part, whatever it may be, to correct these problems.
The Life Extension Foundation is like the largest anti-aging medicine organization in the world. Yet, I think it's safe to say that not exactly a household name. Why is that?
Well, we're focused on research. We spend over $10 million a year on basic research aimed at slowing aging, curing cancer, even eliminating death itself. And we're not someone who's out there advertising on TV a lot. We're not, you know, running big ads or promotional campaigns. So people typically hear about us through word of mouth. We're not a commercial company in the sense that we're trying to promote ourselves on a regular basis. So we've been around since 1980, and yet we have 170,000 members. We've grown quite a bit, but people are not going to hear about us unless a friend or a doctor refers them. And fortunately, a lot of doctors do refer people to us.
Well, I think that most of your members are doctors because, you know, like I have gone places and I've met people and I mentioned Life Extension. They don't know anything, but then they'll go, yeah, but, you know, I saw that magazine in my doctor's office. But
well, you go to scientific conferences that are exclusively MDs and PhDs and DOs, and most of those doctors have heard of us. So we are known in the medical community. But the general public, unless their doctor refers them to us for some blood tests or from certain nutrients, they're just not necessarily going to learn about us. Of course, the Internet is drawing more people to us because people will sometimes type in a disease like pancreatic cancer. And we do have a rather novel pancreatic cancer treatment protocol that's published on our website right now. And then this clinical study that we're funding at the City of Hope Hospital in California, we're incorporating even more innovative ingredients into this cocktail in an attempt to significantly prolong the lives of these advanced pancreatic cancer patients.
And if somebody wanted to be part of, do you have like a way to choose who's going to be part of the study if any of our listeners were interested?
Well, they should certainly email Life Extension, go on our website, and contact our clinical oncology department, and we'll take down their information. They'd have to go out to Southern California to participate in this study, but if it were me and I had advanced pancreatic cancer, I'd be going.
Absolutely.
This study, by the way, is not likely to start for about 6 more months, so it's best for them probably to log onto our website and follow the recipe we currently have, which does incorporate a lot of the ingredients that will be in this clinical study.
And Bill, you know, I'm going to go ahead and round up the show a little bit, but we have an extra about 10 more minutes to go. But before I go, this one product that you have that I want to chat a little bit about, but it's the SAME. I was reading up on it, and I was like thinking that it would be a good product to for my friends. And I wanted to find out, can you give us a little inside scoop about it?
You're talking about S-adenosyl methionine, and we call it SAMI.
Yes.
For short. And that's a nutrient, and it's something that is a constituent of the amino acid, the methionine. And if you take high doses of it, it can confer a lot of nice benefits in the body. It's good for the joint linings. It's good for the liver. It facilitates the production of glutathione in the brain. But where it's been studied the most is in the treatment of depression. And there's been studies showing that SAMI works as well as certain antidepressant drugs, which is not really saying that much because a lot of these drugs don't work that well to begin with, but at least SAMI has been shown to work as well. But the most fascinating study came out of a study done at Harvard University and the Massachusetts General Hospital, where they added SAMI to some conventional antidepressant medications, and they were able to double the efficacy rate. In other words, more than twice as many people improved their depression scores when they took SAMe and a conventional select serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI drug. So that kind of excited us, because we know that these antidepressant drugs have such high failure rates, and yet if you add SAMe to the conventional drug, you double your chances of getting significant relief from depression. Mm-hmm. So that impressed us, and the dose in that particular study was 800 milligrams twice a day of the S-adenosyl methionine, or SAMe. And that's something, by the way, that's approved as a drug in Europe to treat depression. It's sold over the counter in the United States as a dietary supplement.
Wow.
And Life Extension was the first to bring that into the United States back in 1997. We have been recommending our members just buy it in Europe, but it was just so outlandishly priced. Anytime something is a drug, by the way, it typically costs a lot of money. And when it was converted into a dietary supplement in the United States, the price of it went down by now over 70% compared to its prescription drug price in Europe.
Wow, and can I ask you a quick personal question, Bill? Doesn't it make you upset that all this finding that Life Extension Foundation came out with years ago, and now it's come to mainstream? And now, like, for example, SAMe, I remember it was 1996 that you guys brought it out, but here we are 16 years later, and now a published study came out, but not too many people know about this. Doesn't that bother you?
Well, I'm upset enough to write the book Pharmocracy. And I did some promotion for the book. We've gotten some copies out there. A lot of people have bought books and sent it to their congressmen. But I'm mostly troubled by the millions of needless deaths that have occurred since Life Extension was formed in 1980. We brought out scientific information that was validated, and it was very seldom paid attention to. 1981, we recommended to our members if they could get their hands on a hormone called DHEA, dihydroepiandrosterone, that would confer significant protection against immune senescence. As people grow older, they become very vulnerable to pneumonia and influenza. Their immune systems are letting them down. And DHEA, if it's maintained in youthful ranges, can help protect against the decline in immune function that occurs with aging. And yet that was suppressed by the FDA for such a long period of time. We even had two of our members arrested for importing it from Europe for their own personal use. Now, we hired an attorney, and we got those members out of jail, and we won the case. We won the case pretty easily because DHEA was not illegal. But the FDA just decided to take a heavy-handed approach and arrest what was an 81-year-old man and a 46-year-old woman as they went to the post office to pick up their personal supply of DHEA. Well, that was in 1995 that occurred. Well, now you can go to a health food store and you'll see DHEA all over the counter, and the shelves are loaded with it. So, the FDA was absolutely wrong in telling people they shouldn't have it and it was illegal. But they were scientifically incorrect from the standpoint that they denied Americans access to something that could have saved a lot of lives.
That makes me mad, actually, to hear about that they did that.
It's power in the wrong hands.
That's horrible.
It is. The FDA was given absolute power, and we know what happens with absolute power. It corrupts, and it creates inefficiencies. And we're living with that right now. And the email that we sent out last night to our members alerted them to the culprits behind the prescription drug shortage that exists today. And that is the FDA. They were given some power to try to improve safety. And they unfortunately misused that power by accidentally shutting down the manufacturers of the injectable drugs that so many people need to live. Mainly cancer drugs that can extend lifespan and in some cases effect a cure. They accidentally shut down production of these cancer drugs, and there are people dying right now because of the FDA's abuse of power. Maybe the intention was good, but the result is failure. Americans needlessly dying because of a severe prescription drug shortage that exists in this country. It still exists. FDA is trying to undo their mistake, but the fact is, between the FDA abusing their power and Congress then creating a ridiculous law in 2003 that led to unpredictability in what Medicare would pay, a lot of the makers of injectable medications just stopped making them. And we're suffering a drug shortage in this country, so I encourage your listening audience here to stay healthy, because a drug that could have saved your life may not be available when you go to the hospital.
Wow.
That is such a scary... And Bill, promise me you'll come back and visit us. We'll do the show at 7 o'clock just for you, because we have more questions.
Yeah,
we have more, but we have to go. It's about 4 minutes till. And I want to say thank you to you and Dr. Joyelle for coming on and chatting with us. And again, thank you for Life Extension Foundation for doing everything they can. And you know what? I can't wait for my next magazine. That's like, I look forward to it.
Very good, Tanya. I appreciate it. Anyone's welcome to log into our website if they want to see any of our past issues. And we appreciate being on your show.
And if someone wanted to get a hold of Life Extension, where would they go?
Well, our website is lef.org. LEF stands for Life Extension Foundation, .org. And if they want to get a free copy of our magazine, they can call 1-800-841-5433. And we'll be happy to send them out this month's issue, and they can see what we publish every month. Give them an idea of how much information they're not seeing in the mainstream media.
Well, I follow you guys on Twitter, which is Life Extension, and their Facebook page is Life Extension. I follow them. And I also watch the YouTube videos, too. It's called Life Extension Videos. So I follow all that, plus go to the website. But again, Bill, thank you so much. Dr. Joyelle, thank you so much. And you guys have a great day. And we will chat with you later.
Thank you, Tanya.
Bye.